This is Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Attorney General Maura Healey is suing an e-cigarette retailer for marketing to minors. It's the first time she's brought charges against an e-cigarette company after her office launched an investigation into the industry last year. She alleges that the New Jersey-based company Eon Smoke has been directly targeting their products to minors. We spoke with Attorney General Maura Healey at her office about those charges earlier today.
Eon Smoke is one of these companies that's an e-cigarette company. And for a year now, I have been talking a lot about vaping and how pervasive it is and what a big-time problem it is for our young people. I constantly hear from parents about kids vaping. And, you know, we've had companies come to market like Juul, like Eon Smoke, who, in our view, are out there and engaging in unfair and deceptive sales and marketing practices that violate Massachusetts law. We have a rule here in Massachusetts, a law here in Massachusetts, that prohibits the sale of e-cigarettes to people under the age of 21. And we filed a lawsuit just today against Eon Smoke for violating our laws by selling product into Massachusetts to kids underage, and by flouting laws that are there to ensure that customers are old enough to buy their products. So it's a big health risk for young people, a big problem in our state, in fact, across this country. And we're really trying to take this on because I think it's really, really important.
So Michael Tomach, Eon Smoke's co-founder and CEO, told the Boston Globe that he's been cooperating with your office. He said that he has, quote, taken some of the most aggressive actions of anyone in the industry to combat youth usage, including ceasing sales to the state on the website, scrubbing social media, and more. Do you agree with that?
Well, here's what our investigation has showed. For decades, we worked hard to stop young people from smoking. And these companies have come in and created a whole new market of smokers, basically, those who will use e-cigarette products. And what our investigation found is that, basically, Eon Smoke took a page right out of Big Tobacco. They made flavors that appealed to kids, Sour Patch, cotton candy, cake. And then they used a social media campaign and graphics that really were meant to target and appeal to young people. So they're marketing to kids, they marketed to kids, they flouted our laws, and this is a problem. So our job is to go out and enforce the law. We want to recover damages and civil penalties for the conduct we allege, and we want this to stop. It is imperative that these companies not sell into Massachusetts to an underage market. I spent a lot of time, Kim, with pediatricians, you know, who right now are treating so many young people who are nicotine addicted. Nicotine has a different effect on the lungs and the brain development of young people than it does on adults. And this is a real problem. So we're going to be aggressive here. We're out doing a lot of education and awareness raising because, unfortunately, I think a lot of people thought this was sort of harmless water vapor.
Right.
And it turns out it's not.
So you mentioned Juul, another e-cigarette company. Other states, including North Carolina, have brought suit against them. You're still investigating. What's the difference between Juul and Eon Smoke here?
They're very similar. And in fact, our investigation of Juul started earlier, but we have to do our job too and do the work that I think is necessary. And so we're still in the midst of investigating Juul. My colleague, though, Josh Stein, did bring the only other case against Juul by a state, brought by the state of North Carolina the other day. I expect we'll see more. You know, what we've seen here is really, as I say, a page from the playbook of Big Tobacco. The use of flavors, the use of cartoon characters, the use of social media to drive and appeal to a young audience because they're concerned about the loss of market share as smoking rates have gone down across this country. And one way to pick that up is to create a whole new market of young people. And that's why Altria, formerly known as Philip Morris, a big cigarette company, took a 35% stake in Juul recently. They put $12 billion into Juul. They know where the market is. They know where they want to grow the market. And so that's what's going on here. And we just need to make sure we are protecting young people, protecting consumers, and ultimately this is about public health.
And I also wanted to ask, your predecessor, former Attorney General Martha Coakley, joined the government affairs team at Juul, and you returned a donation that she sent to you, a $200 donation. What message were you trying to send with that?
It's actually consistent with our policy, which is not to take money from companies, actors under investigation.
I want to turn now to national news and talk of impeachment among Democrats. Yesterday, we heard from Special Counsel Robert Mueller, and a lot of Democrats, including some members of the Massachusetts delegation, are saying they would like to the House to proceed with impeachment. What do you think? Do you think impeachment should be the next move?
No, I think you have to look at and listen to what Robert Mueller said yesterday. And you have to understand, I think the American public, it's a time of education, too, for the American public, because this isn't something we've had to think about or confront regularly as a country. But I think more people now are gaining the education about, okay, what does this mean? Robert Mueller made very clear yesterday that his investigation was not an exoneration of President Trump, but essentially, when A.G. Barr spoke, he was lying when he characterized it as such, and that there were serious issues and facts uncovered as a result of the investigation. He also made it clear that he could not, as a special prosecutor operating within Justice Department guidelines and guidelines set by the Office of Legal Counsel, bring a charge of obstruction of justice. That was off the table. He was legally precluded from doing that. He did not say that wasn't warranted. What he did say is that his job at that point, given that that criminal process was not attainable, available, because of the rules, his job was to then make the referral to Congress. Congress needs to do its job. It needs to get to the bottom of this. I think if people took the time to read the report, and of course it's so interesting, so many people are commenting, so many people are espousing thoughts, they now read the report, right? To read that report, there is so much there, and I think there absolutely should be a thorough effort going forward, including whether you call it impeachment or something else. They need to get to the bottom of what happened.
Well, Special Counsel Mueller made it pretty clear that he said everything he wanted to say in the report.
Mm-hmm.
So if all the information is there, what should Congress do?
They should be reading it, and they should be taking testimony, calling witnesses, asking for documents as appropriate. I mean, the Office of Special Counsel did a tremendous amount of work in that report, and it's just the facts. And now the job is for Congress to actually review that and take the steps appropriate based on their assessment of the law and the facts. I think he made it really clear that the ball is now in Congress's court. He couldn't act. He did his job. Now it is Congress's turn to do its job.
I want to switch to the topic of immigration. Two district attorneys, Marion Ryan and Rachel Rollins, are suing ICE over the practice of apprehending people in courthouses. This is one thing that Donald Trump has made a big issue of in citing them. But this is one issue where you haven't taken legal action. Why?
Well, I haven't taken legal action, but I've been supportive. And, you know, unfortunately, immigration has been used by President Trump as a political football, as something to incite, exacerbate, take advantage of, exploit tensions within communities and across this country. It is so unfortunate. And we've had to act as an office to file lawsuits, to fight the travel ban, to defend the DACA program, to fight family separation on the border. The list goes on. We also spend a lot of time here working with immigrant communities in Massachusetts. I remember probably about a year ago sending out letters to community health centers and hospitals, sending letters to schools, because we were getting reports that parents were afraid to take their kids to pediatric visits or to the hospital. They were afraid to show up in court. They were afraid to go to school for fear that ICE would come and they would be detained or deported. And it was just, that's not healthy for our communities. It's not healthy for public health. It's not healthy for public safety. And I think what the district attorneys are concerned about is the fact that we have courthouses with criminal proceedings going on and civil proceedings going on, by the way, where we need victims to come to court. We need witnesses to come to court. We need defendants to come to court. And the actions by ICE at times in Massachusetts, the concern is, have had a chilling effect on people coming to court. That's not good for our community. It's not good for our system. It's not good for law enforcement.
So how do you strike the balance then? You want to have people who may be dangerous. You want to have the interest of public safety while at the same time not scaring members of the community and having them not participate in the criminal justice proceedings. How do you strike that balance?
Well, you know, day in and day out, my office, other offices are working with local, state, and federal officials, including ICE, okay? We all share the goal of keeping people who are a danger to the community off of the street, right? That is really important. But there are ways, and there have been ways to deal with this. But we've seen actions lately by ICE that are above and beyond, that are different. And I think that's what the district attorneys are really calling into account. There's absolutely a way, Kim, to strike that balance, a way to ensure public safety while also ensuring that people aren't scared to come to court. I mean, imagine the woman who is a victim of domestic violence, who's afraid to go to court to get a restraining order against her abuser because of this. Imagine, you know, the grandmother who desperately needs to deal with a housing situation or something related to a probate and family court matter with respect to the care of her grandkids, who's afraid to come to court. That's not good, right? So we want to make sure we're not doing things that keep those people from coming to court, while we also want to work cooperatively with all across law enforcement, federal, state, and local, to keep those who are a danger to our communities off of the streets.
On that same issue, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling indicted Newton District Court Judge Shelley Joseph for helping a defendant leave the courthouse before they could be apprehended. You've called that case politically motivated, but Governor Charlie Baker called the allegations against Judge Joseph disturbing and said nobody is above the law. Is this a case that's worthy to go to trial, in your opinion?
Well, I didn't think it was a case worthy of federal investigation or indictment. You know, look, we'll learn more, I suppose, through what ultimately ever comes of that prosecution. But my point has been this. This is completely unprecedented, what happened here. The U.S. Department of Justice, a U.S. Attorney's Office, charging criminally, federally charging a sitting state court judge who was in her state courthouse engaged in her responsibility activity as a state court judge. We have a separation between state and federal government, and I really viewed this as an instance that raised issues with respect to separation of powers and the balance between state and federal government. And my point has been, there are ways to deal with this. In fact, this was dealt with by the trial courts shortly after this came to light. There are ways to deal with this through the Judicial Conduct Commission, for example. And this just really was not, as a matter of prosecutorial resources, appropriate in my view. But ultimately, it will be up to a court to decide. But these are, you know, these are challenging times and times of a lot of chaos and confusion, frankly, sown by the Trump administration. And they've led to a lot of confusion out there in a lot of places and a lot of unnecessary fear and anxiety. And, you know, that's also been something we've been trying to temper and quell these last couple of years.
I want to turn now to the Museum of Fine Arts. Last week, it was revealed that middle school students from Dorchester during a trip there were subject to racist comments, drew a lot of attention, and the folks at the Museum of Fine Arts said they want to work to ensure that the museum is always inclusive to the community. What was your reaction when you found out about that story, and what do you think it says about inclusiveness here in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, I read it, and I asked my team to reach out both to the MFA and to the school, to the teachers and the students, to understand more about what happened. I think it's really important that we take these opportunities to address systemic racism, to address unconscious bias, to address racial profiling, you know, just within our society, right? And so, you know, obviously more needs to be investigated and learned. And the museum is doing that. They've done some of that, right, about the particulars of this incident. But to me, I guess, I look at just if a young child feels that they have been racially profiled, that's a problem for all of us. It almost doesn't matter what the actual actions were there or interactions or what was said. It's like if that young person has that feeling, then we have to, as a society, account for why is it that that young black girl, that young black boy from Dorchester felt that way. That's on all of us. I don't think we can talk enough about these issues, and they're not comfortable to talk about, you know, but we have to, you know. We spend a lot of time in this office focused on these issues. We've brought cases in the past where, you know, a department store was engaged in racial profiling and it came to surveying shoppers in the store. We sued the tannery for its actions by its owner. You know, discriminating in our view against patrons who are coming through the door. But, you know, there's the subtle forms of discrimination too, right? And that's why we have to do unconscious bias training. I did it in my office out of the gate. It's why we have a strong diversity and inclusion committee here in my office that's really focused on hiring practices and retention practices. And it's really resulted in changed the way we do a lot of things. And we're not perfect, but we're engaged in it. And I think just all of us collectively need to be engaged in this.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about Purdue Pharma as well. 2 weeks ago in North Dakota, a lawsuit against Purdue Pharma was dismissed, and the judge questioned the idea that a company could be held accountable. Judge James Hill wrote, "Purdue cannot control how doctors prescribe its product, and it certainly cannot control how individual patients use and respond to its products." Now, Massachusetts is one of the states that is pursuing legal action against this, saying that their practices, their marketing practices, encourage the opioid addiction epidemic. How do you square that with what this judge is saying? Do you see this as a legal obstacle moving forward with these cases?
Not at all. You know, that case, look, I'm not going to speak to how it was litigated or the job they did. I will tell you it was a different claim than the claims that we've brought in our case. So it doesn't actually have any import or effect. Here's what our case is about. We sued Purdue and the Sacklers and other officers and directors because, in our view, after an extensive 3-year investigation, it was quite clear that this was a company that engaged in unfair and deceptive sales and marketing practices that were about getting as many people hooked on Purdue opioids at as high a dose as possible for as long as possible. Back in 2007, this was a company that paid a $600 million fine. 3 of its executives pled guilty. They were later paid, of course, buyouts. But and then proceeded to, this was a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice. After that, right, when you would think that having been called out and having resolved this, they'd stop engaging in bad practices, they proceeded to really double down here in Massachusetts and across this country with respect to sales of Oxy. Since 2007 in Massachusetts alone, there were 150,000 visits to doctors' offices by Purdue sales representatives, over 70 million doses of Purdue products in Massachusetts, $500 million in revenue. We have documents showing Purdue sales reps being in a doctor's office, you know, at the end of the week and then looking at, you know, who was coming in the following week and going back the following week to the doctor's office to make sure that those patients had been prescribed Purdue opioids. This was the kind of aggressive marketing that this company was engaged in. And what our investigation revealed, and I think, you know, it was important, the complaint that we filed, it's the first time these documents have come to light. These documents that show, these are Purdue documents, emails, memos, and the like, that show that the board, Sackler family members, had direct control over the sales and marketing plans. They were keeping tabs on prescriptions in a community, and they knew the correlation between prescriptions and the impact. They were targeting, they had plans to target veterans, seniors. They had plans to target doctors who were known for prescribing a lot of pills and to get them to prescribe more. And we've seen the devastation here in Massachusetts and all over this country. And it is incredibly important that we get truth, that we get accountability, and that there be transparency. That's what the public deserves. That's what the families I speak with and sit with regularly deserve.
And what's the status of that case right now? Where does it stand?
Active litigation right now. You know, Purdue, of course. I mean, the thing with Purdue and the Sacklers is for years they've tried to bury information, enter into confidential settlement agreements, and really keep the Sackler family name out of this. And we've brought that front and center because we believe that they are responsible and liable for some of this conduct. And so, you know, they've been fighting with us, moving to dismiss our case. Ultimately, that's going to be up for a judge to decide, but we're just going to be aggressive moving forward. This is an incredibly important matter, and to me, it's just an instance of corporate greed and profits over people in a way that is really, really sickening.
I want to turn to 2020. The Democratic field
is... What's happening in 2020?
There's a bit of an election, a little election. You may have heard about it. And several dozens of Democrats are now running, including two members of the Massachusetts delegation. Have you given any thought to who you might support in the race
And don't
yet?
Forget Bill Weld.
And also, correct, on the Republican side, there is a third Massachusetts person, Bill Weld, correct.
Yeah. Look, I think it's great that there's a big field on the Democratic side. I look forward to the debates in coming weeks. I think that's going to make for a stronger candidate. I've worked with and enjoyed working with and have respect for so many folks who are running. And so, you know, I'm going to continue to be supportive of the party. The other thing that's happening in 2020 is the census. And we took the Trump administration to court because they tried to do things to the census that would basically result in the undercounting of people in our state and in states across this country. Particularly, they wanted to add a citizenship question, which everybody who's been a commerce secretary that's still alive under both Republican and Democratic administrations says is a way to suppress and lower the count. Every person counts. That's our point here. And if we don't get this right, and if we don't have our folks counted here in the state of Massachusetts, we're going to lose federal funding, and we're going to lose electoral representation. And that's really something that we've got to join together in getting people registered.
And just today, there was reported that one of the architects of including this question on the census said in writing that the purpose of it was to depress Democratic votes. Is that going to impact your litigation?
Yeah, that comes through, I mean, our litigation. We're going after, you know, and deposing these people, getting the documents, getting the emails that I believe will show this was a calculated effort by the Commerce Department, the Justice Department, and directly the Trump administration to lower the vote to the advantage of the Republican Party, and to make sure that states like Massachusetts and New York and California are weakened.
One last question. There are lots of elections coming up, including in 2020, means a potential open seat in the Senate if Senator Warren is successful in her bid. Have you given a thought to your political future? Are you interested in a potential Senate run or some other office down the road?
I have no plans to run for Senate. I love my job, Kim, and obviously, in my view at least, I think we got our hands full. A lot happening, a lot on our plate here in the office, so I'm really, really focused on that.
All right. That's Attorney General Maura Healey. Thank you for your time.
Oh, great to be with you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we check on the world of sports. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston.